All right, all you chickens, let's put you in the hen house. All right, so what I'd like to do, first of all, should I wait?
Wait a second.
Yeah.
We're starting, guys.
That is too much fun. We go now? Jesus. All right. Hey, guys. How are you? I'm David. And before we begin, I know we had a little respite. I know we had a little piece of, we got to digest this wonderful man's share, who I've known several years now, and I love him to death. I really do. I truly do. And what's your last name? But before we begin, a very important, this is a very special weekend for me. I have never done a retreat, and I've been in program for 50 years. This young man who came with me means more to me than I could tell him, but he does know that. And I've asked him to read and start us off and to read something that he has no idea he's about to read. And I pray that you pay attention to this, because I'd like this to be the beginning right now.
Chris, you want to come up here and read it?
Chris.
Want me to take this back?
No, just leave it there.
Oh. Come up. You just, yeah, that way it gets on.
Lord, today help me set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, for a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and my own recovery.
Thank you. That prayer has become, and I never heard that prayer growing up, it's so powerful for me, and the big word there is everything. Everything. To let everything that we know go, probably one of the hardest things in the world for me to do. Thank you all for having me. I knew very few of you when I walked in here, other than Roger and Christopher. And in the shortest amount of time possible, I've gotten to know you all. And whether I had a direct conversation with you or I just heard you share your heart, I listened to every word of every share to the best of my ability. And it's the most soothing thing I've ever done. There are times I might, I might have been distracted and going off and I miss. There's always a nugget in every share. Every single share has something, not just that I need to hear, but that individual needs to say. And he sat and listened to me. And out of respect and dignity, I need to honor his share completely, absolutely. And, I came up today and it's an odd thing to be asked to lead, maybe not for you, but for me to lead for an hour. I love my program. I understand this program, I believe. To be asked to lead for an hour at an event like this is profoundly unique for me, because it's an ample amount of time to take my time, not feel rushed, settle down, and yet my priority is to honor all of you. I love new individuals because we're growing, we're attracting. And they're the lifeblood of the program. And I love being in meetings, at the same meeting, with men of experience and time, because, we share. As an old timer, I listen to new people, not always to remind me. I don't want to be reminded of a lot of stuff. You know, and I feel sad, but the fresh approach of a young individual, you know, starting their step work, hitting 30 days, 40 days, you know, whatever it is, 60 days, you know, just getting a year in this program is an incredible feat because it is a cult, you know? You knew it was a cult, right? Everybody knows it's a cult. It's the unique cult, though. It is the hardest cult to get into, the easiest one to get out of. And it's free, just about. So, you know, typically our shares touch on these ideas of experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. It sounds like corny word to me. You know, what I've evolved into is what I thought it was like, what I thought happened, and what I think of my life now. And the reason I've evolved to that is, you know, and I'll talk a little bit about who I am, because I don't know any of you. I do live in Los Angeles. I'm 69 in about 3 weeks. That's a head spinner in itself. I was born in the Bronx. I'm Dominican and Mexican. My father, Joseph Alva, he grew up in Mexico, Veracruz, and at 18 years of age, he jumped on a train and he went to New York City. He went to a university, he studied mathematics, and he had a master's degree in engineering. He was a genius, and he was a math whiz. Yay me. And, you know, he's an incredible guy, little guy, 5'3". And, but the personality of like James Cagney, something like that. And my mother is from the Dominican Republic. Wild background to her story, incredibly wild. David, you know, I have a mother that is going to be 100 next in February, and she can't read. She's never been able to read. She has a third grade education in a third world country, which probably amounts to kindergarten. The most powerful woman I've ever met. The most powerful woman who taught me one thing. To trust God. And I grew up in, so my parents were first generation, not first generation, I'm first generation. They were immigrants. Mother came in through Ellis Island, all separate. All the kids were separate because they had been divided back in Dominican Republic. There was a lot of insanity in there. No alcoholism, it wasn't about that. It was very, very, very poor. Okay, so the only way to even get out was for my grandmother to jump on a boat, cross the Atlantic, go to Ellis Island, and start a life, and then send for her kids, her three girls and her boy. While that was going on, each kid was given to a friend. Two of them were sent to one, my mother and her sister. Another sister went to another family. None of them were together. That's the only way they could do it. They lived in shacks. And there was a day that my mother was probably about 5 and her little sister was 2. And they would make these big vats of syrup, sugary syrup. And they'd pour it out and they'd make candy and wrap it up. And my mom and the kids would go in town and they'd sell it. And there was a day that it was boiling and the 2-year-old was, something happened and the thing spilled over all over the 2-year-old girl in front of my mom. And it took her 2 days to die. It was slow, there are no doctors there. And my mother has never spoken of it in her life. And I know that about my mom. I know her ability to withstand anything. You know, the rest of them came and my mother and my dad lived in New York. Well, they met in New York and my dad was a smooth cat and he'd be in Manhattan and he'd be on the subway. And my mom was stunningly beautiful and very proper. And my dad saw her on the subway going to work and every day he would try to be really nice and meet her. And then the stories were beautiful. And it turned out there was one day he asked her where she was going. And she was going to see a movie with her sister and the one that didn't pass. And my dad showed up sitting behind him in the theater. And they started dating after that, and it was great. And they were married for about 7 years in New York, not having kids, which is very unique for a Latina woman to not have any kids well into her 20s. But then my mother was into the fashion industry, not a model. I mean, she was a worker, you know, in a really nice couture place. She was a seamstress. And my dad had become an engineer, and my sister and I were born there. We were born in New York. But my dad had, he was a visionary, man. He was always looking for something next. And he came to, the idea back then was to, that was the mid-50s, 1957, to come out to California, to Los Angeles in particular, because it was booming. And he designed freeways. So he came out to Los Angeles, worked for the Department of Highways. We lived over by, South LA, quite far south, Crenshaw, Western, down near 190th. And it was cool. Man, we lived in a little apartment. We lived above a factory, a little clothing factory. My mom's sewing in there. And my dad's working downtown, second in Los Angeles. And it was cool. And we lived in that. And, you know, we moved up, and by the time I was about 8, parents had another couple of kids. We're living in Silver Lake in an 800 square foot house. It was a 2-bedroom house. We had a bathroom that was the middle of the house. Not a good idea, you know, windows. And 1-bedroom, 4 kids, 2 parents. Had the best life ever. I had shared a room with my sister well till we were like 11. And you know, we were either yelling at each other or laughing with each other. And it was a great time. You know, there was not a lot of distractions. We had 2 TVs. The bottom TV made sound. The top TV made picture, right? And it was like, we didn't care. It was good. You know, all the plastic covered furniture was really nice. But man, we had a blast. It was family. It was beautiful. And I grew up in a Catholic home. I grew up in a liberal home, a Democrat home. Politics is not my thing. But I did grow up in that. I grew up with that mentality. My father was so honored to be a citizen of the United States. He worked to become a citizen. He was honorable. He taught me about politics. He made me sit in front of the television every time John F. Kennedy spoke. And I was a little boy. And I saw my dad sob when that man was killed. My dad had a heart, and I had a great childhood. And the one, if I had to say the one dysfunction, I never saw him suffer. I never saw an argument about money. The argument was about too much dressing on the salad. The word divorce never happened, ever. And I had an uncle, Rafa, and he is my dad's younger brother who adored. My brother was like the nicest man, and he took care of all his family. So my uncle came following my dad to Los Angeles. He settled here, and eventually he got married, and he was always at our house. He was always at our house, like daily. And he was a cholo, man. He had greaser hair, you know. And I'm like, I like this dude, man. And he'd come to the kitchen, and he'd kick back on the chair and talk to my mom like this. And it was great because my mom's talking Dominican. He's talking Mexican. I'm talking English. It's great. And he'd get up, and there'd be a big grease stain on the wall. And, you know, but that was a great childhood, man. And what I didn't realize, you know, somebody the other day asked me, do you know what you were like at 7? Not like, what were you doing at 7? They asked me, what were you like at 7? And I really thought about that, and I said, I have no idea. Because at that age, I was in the moment. I wasn't wondering where I was gonna go next year, or, you know, I didn't have much past to think about. And, you know, it was a joyful time. I had a ton of friends, and yet the same neighborhood was violent. There were 2 opposing gangs. I knew them all. A lot of my friends' older brothers were involved with gangs. There was always a chance that any one of us, we were always, you know, protected by you know, the crew in our neighborhood. And but as beautiful as my home was, I saw death. I was standing next to my, wow. And I was standing next to Mike McGee, and we were 13, and we were walking to the park. It was late at night, and there was a car drove by, and I heard a gunshot, and they got him. And it wasn't supposed to be him. They didn't. They thought it was somebody else. I could have been shot, and he didn't die, but he moved away. He was hurt really bad. And, you know, I learned how to live in that. And I really wasn't afraid because I knew everybody. I knew Egghead. That really was a guy's name. Anyway, so I grew up in that neighborhood, and it was in Hollywood. It was during the 60s, and I eventually went to high school. And around that time, around 13 years of age, 14 years of age. Actually, right when I graduated my lower level school, I went to school to be a priest. And that was the year that, you know, at the same time I'm going to priest and some word celibacy came out. It's the same year I'd be going home on the weekends and a lot of fun stuff was happening. So I quickly left this world of the innocence of my home, the integrity of the school that I had attended, and I kicked it to the curb because I was drawn to this other lifestyle and I pursued a life that was... trying to now shift into an environment that was nothing like the environment at home. A lot of lines are being crossed. A lot of drugs are being used. A lot of boy-girl things are beginning to happen. You know, there's a lot of boy-girl parties. That's where we all started. Now the things that started were, you know, self-consciousness. Walking up to a girl that you really like and asking her out scared me to death. Walking into a party where there's a bunch of dudes, you know, and I had to look like I was comfortable. Hardest thing in the world. In an environment where nobody showed fear. And somewhere, and it was one day where there were five of us sitting in the back of an old Woody, abandoned Woody, and we were smoking our first joint. And I love these guys. We were all best friends, and all of us, I think for one, it was our first time. And that was the day everything changed. Every single thing changed. And I'll refer to that later. By 19 years of age, a lot had happened. No more seminary, horrible relationships with my parents. I'm crossing a bunch of lines. By the time I'm 19, you know, I'm out of my house, but I go to beauty school and land in beauty school. And, you know, my father had asked me to leave the house. A bunch of things had happened, a lot of police things, a lot of car trauma. You know, some people drink and drive. I drink while I drive. And so but by 19, man, that was, you know, kind of the end of a run, you know, and thankfully, you know, I got escorted, you know, by LAPD to jail several times and then eventually to a meeting. First introduction at 19 years of age to any type of recovery program. First idea, first time I ever heard an alcoholic talk about recovery. And I in no way thought I belonged there at all. I'm like, you guys are kind of old. They're probably like 28. And and I just, you know, there was something there that I kind of would listen to. And, you know, I had my little court card and listened to it. And it's good stuff, you know, but I got to go. And I did make friends. I didn't hate it, but it's just, you know, man, I didn't relate. It wasn't there, man. And I left that and pursued my life. But I knew there was something different. I was only living at home. So now I had to... make a living, pursue a living, and, you know, dude, put it out there, man. I'm going for it. I work hard. I've always worked hard. I'm Latino. We work hard. So I went out, I went to beauty school all day, had fun doing that, pursued a career, worked all night, and I partied after that. And it was a couple years later where this career was the most incredible gift for me, because I loved everyone in it and I loved the life, and I was actually able to do it. And the moment came when a gentleman in that place pulled me aside, who I loved and respected, and most of us did. And he pulled me aside and he said, look, we all do party, but when you drink, you scare people. And if you don't do something about it, I have to fire you. And my knees went weak. He was like a dad to me. I went to AA, and I'm not losing my job. And from that day forward, that was my life. I was so committed. I went back to the same meeting I went to when I had a court card. There were some people there. And there was a real nice guy who said, I knew you'd be back. And I'd been back to that. And so I lived that life. I was involved with that until somewhere along worked my program, and I enjoyed it. You know, it was great. I mean, I didn't have a lot of responsibilities. I had a killer job, and I wasn't drinking. I was enjoying the fun Beverly Hills meetings. You know, those are, you know, Roxbury and things like that. It was cool. And so it was kind of a social thing for me, like Steb Schmitz, you know, we're having a good time here, you know, and it's fun. I was really into the personalities, you know, and I was young and I hadn't been challenged. And somewhere along the line, in my 30s, I met my first wife and we got married, and we had a couple of kids, and that lasted, you know, we had a couple of kids that we raised. It was a great marriage. It started off incredible marriage. I was sober, and I met this woman 3 months after I got sober. Yeah. And, you know, I was good, man. I was fixed. But, you know, I thought it all out. I used my best thinking. And I decided that, you know, I dated her twice. I called my friend. I said, I met my wife. I'm going to marry this lady. And we did get married, and it was a sober home. She didn't drink. She wasn't in program and knew nothing of it. We didn't talk about anything regarding program in that home. But I was fine with that because it's my thing. So I go to my meetings. And that worked for a bit. We got married. We had a couple of kids. And somewhere around kids, you know, 4, 5, 6, you know, a lot of responsibility for her. She's kind of hinting around like, you have to go to a meeting tonight. You just worked all day and kids and this, you know. I'm like, yeah, you know, and, you know, the life that God gave me, you know, got me out of AA, you know. And I just simply wasn't involved. I wasn't in recovery. I was dry. Marriage kind of dwindled. A lot of issues. Boom, that's over. And that's heading down the path. And there's two kids living in that home. And they're watching these things go on, and eventually ended. At the time that it ended, my son was about 14. My daughter was 11. 14, 11, yeah. And, you know, you start that whole process, you know, two homes. And, you know, initially you try to have this civilized kind of thing going on. And it's just challenging. Somewhere along the line, within a year and a half, both kids are now living with me. So I'm a single dad. I used to call that. I co-parented to a degree, not much. I had them most of the time. They were in private schools. They were doing well, played music. They played piano. They were social. They were both very good looking kids. I had an amazing time during that time. I loved being with my kids. I coached. I went everywhere with my daughter. My son and I raced motocross. My son and I and Christopher raced bicycles. It was amazing. It was amazing. And somewhere around my daughter's 13th, 14th birthday, I found out that she had smoked her first joint. From that day forward, everything changed. I was no longer looking at her as the girl that I felt safe with. Now, I'm checking everything. I'm on hyper alert. I'm a good dad, okay? And I'm, you know, God forbid I attempt to check the phone, because that little 95-pound girl will beat me to death if I touch that phone. That phone was private. And somehow I got a hold of that phone and I read something I didn't really want to read. But I read it, and of course I had to have this soft conversation. Honey, we got to talk about this. I understand. It's common. I'm not yelling at you, but I want you to know that, you know, I really care about your safety. So what I think would be a really good idea is if you only smoked at home. That way, in case you buy something that's tainted, I'm right here. And if you use too much, I'm right here. The next weekend, there were three other girls in my backyard with a bong. And I'm like, what's this? She's like, well, Dad, you said I have to smoke at home. I said, but who are they? They said, oh, no, we told all their parents that you're okay with it. That was the beginning of a whole different life. That was how it started. From that day until their ages of probably my daughter, probably the age of 16, and my son approaching 20, it had accelerated to the point of meth, eventually heroin, eventually my son and I never being able to talk in a home that you didn't want to be in. And I worked all day, worked really hard. I'd come home. My neighbors would say, I live in the cul-de-sac. I knew my neighbors forever. They loved my kids. My kids grew up there from the time they were little. They'd pull me aside and they'd go, dude, we love your kids. But this whole neighborhood smells of dope. And they're all going to your house while you're at work. Okay? Problem. Conversations are starting to become insane. I'm starting to unravel, right? I'm starting to not sleep. I'm starting to obsess. I am totally fucking distracted all the time. I'm interacting with you and I haven't heard a word you said. I'm driving home, I don't remember driving home. I'm not okay. And I'm yelling at people. I'm crying, you know? And I find out about Parent Al-Anon 15 years ago. It was two blocks from my house. And I walked in there to this same identical room that I've gone to my other programs meeting for 20 years. I never knew that meeting was there. I never knew those people. Those are my people. I walked to that Al-Anon parent meeting and every share brought me to my knees. These people had children in prison. They had children on heroin, on meth, on the streets, homeless. And at the time that I walked in there, we were just out of marijuana. So I'm listening to these stories like, I gotta go. This is scary. We're not this bad. And I knew better than to leave because there wasn't another show in town. And my AA program was not addressing this. And so I started attending this meeting, and it is the most beautiful experience and the most painful experience that I've ever gone through in my life. I got to know families that were working this program that were so incredibly stable. And when I heard you got a nice laugh, you got a good smile, and you also have a daughter who's been homeless for 15 years, how is that possible? And I was gonna find out. I saw the evidence of help. I saw the evidence of joy in the middle of the worst situation imaginable. So I had to participate. I had to go in. And, you know, delusionally or maybe ignorantly, as I started this program, I really believed that it was going to be strategically directed towards solving, I won't use the word fix, because when I tried to fix them, I only did it for one reason. I couldn't stand how I felt. If I told you I was trying to, I knew that's not going to fix them. I knew dragging my daughter in the rehab was not going to fix. I knew better. I knew better than all those parents in that AA parent room as an alcoholic, and yet I still wasn't doing what they told me to do because I was still an alcoholic, and I'm highly sensitive, I'm highly reactive, and I'm watching these kids become me, and I couldn't stand it. And for the next, you know, few years that they were there, it was insane. I mean, there were police at my house. There was, you know, kids that I really wish weren't anywhere near my street in my home. Then the big stuff happened. And there was a moment where somehow I couldn't stay. I maneuvered my daughter into a residential treatment center. And it was against her better judgment, but I thought, you're gone. You know, if I want to wait till you're ready, I'll die. And I did it. I dropped her off at the front door, and the guy says, you know, she does need toiletries. And I said, I'll be right back. Right down the street is a Rite Aid. Went there, got stuff, came back. And I walk in, and I thought, oh, they took her in. And he goes, she left. And my heart just sunk. And I walk out to my car, and I drive my car home. And 15 minutes later, the phone rings. And it is the FBI saying, your son's been arrested, and he's requesting an attorney. You say FBI? Why do you have my son? He's believed to have done a lot of things, and we're not going to talk right now. I'm just letting you know if you want to be his contact for an attorney. I was to find out later because he had already moved out of my house for a couple years. He had been dealing weed out of my house. He was now dealing meth. He was a meth addict. He had already moved out of the house. I had a description of the arrest. He was in this apartment where he dealt all his things out of. He had 9 employees. He was distributing around the country. He had 2 Porsches. He had $3 million. And he didn't mess around. He's 6'2", yoked. Tatted, yoked, shaved head. He used to be in Little League. And on that day, I realized I had heard something a very, very long time ago by a speaker. And it's a very long story, but I'll summarize it by saying he said something about acceptance. He said, the quicker you accept it, the easier it is. And somehow, these two items in that moment were way bigger than I was going to get through. I was not going to get through it. And somehow, I went into this odd state of like, okay, all right, that's what it is. And then it progressed. The whole legal thing with him progressed. All the court things and lawyer things, I got to hear a lot about it. Daughter did not ever go into rehab. My mistake. She didn't go to that one. She went to another one. And about 6 months later, again, not wanting to go. And she left there having met her next heroin dealer. So I thought that was charming. So that was the beginning of both kids. Well, actually, my daughter came back to live for a little bit. It was insane at that time. Son was out. At that time, Maybe the order is wrong, but she did come back home to live, and it was really difficult because we were not even talking, and it was just her and I. And she was in, you know, she'd come home 2 or 3 in the morning with her girls, make a bunch of mess in the kitchen, and then she'd, you know, disappear. I'd wake up in the morning, there'd be a mess. And I don't know what I asked her to please clean up the kitchen. It's noon, you know, because you clean up the kitchen. And, you know, didn't respond. I said, I'm not kidding. And she gets up and gets right in front of me, in my face, and says, you are nothing but an asshole. And this hand went right up, smacked her, and I have never touched her till that minute. You'd think that would startle her. She cold cocked me. She's a peewee thing. We're on the ground. She's beautiful. She was loaded. I stop it within a minute. I'm what? Dogs barking. The dog bowls are flying. I'm like, what? Just stop. What is going on? Go to your room. I'm in the room. I'm having a heart. I'm going, what the fuck is going on? LAPD. Get against the wall. Chop, chop. Handcuffs, just like old times. I don't even care. Take me. Don't ever let me out of jail. I'd rather be there. It's predictable. I'm fed. And the lady talks to me outside. She goes, lady cop. They bring a lady because this is a young lady. And she sits me outside in handcuffs. She said, look, bro, I got the same thing at home. I feel you. But I can't do a thing about this. You have to go deal with it later on. And I went to court. And as my attorney friend said to me, it's not a problem, man. Once I explained to the police, to the judge, what you were dealing with, I said, does that mean you're going to put her on the stand? He goes, yeah. And I sat for a second. I go, you know, I'd rather not do that. I'd rather take it. I did hit her. I do not want you putting my daughter up there and tearing her apart. Never. Leave her be. And I cleaned toilets for a year on Venice. And I was fucking happy to be there. I was there every Wednesday for a year, and I was in a DV class at the same treatment center my daughter walked out of. And I loved that meeting. I learned more about myself and that domestic violence and my reactive nature, and I realized how other men think that aren't even in program. And my daughter was out, my son was out, and you know, I'm working this program like there's no tomorrow. And now things got real. You know, things got very real in my program because I had serious things going on. I had a kid going to prison, a daughter out on the streets on heroin, meth addict over here, heroin addict over here, and I'm living alone trying to figure out how to have a life. I got to go to work. I talk to people all day long. Everybody in my chair knows my kids. How's the kids? How's the kids all day long? Oh, did I show you my kid graduating college? Did I show you my daughter that your daughter used to hang around with? She's getting married. That shit killed me, man. I was never so ashamed because I knew I'm never, in my mind, I said, I will never have that. And I had to start working on a really deeply rooted thing. And it was a grief. You know, I came into Al-Anon with all kinds of kind of mixed emotions and peculiar ideas. And I often thought of this idea, is Al-Anonism a disease? For me, it's not. I'm just insane. I had a good home. If anything, I'm highly sensitive. If anything, I respond to a 10-cent problem with a $100 response. That's for sure. I'm a dad, and I love my kids more than even I ever knew. And when I come to the holidays now, and I haven't sat with my son during the holidays in 7 years, I love the holidays because I want to. I want to enjoy my life. And I've learned through this program, you can. And I can replace calamity with serenity. It tells me that. It promises me that. I got to earn it. So I started working these steps at a level that I have never worked any other 12-step program, because I was more afraid now than I had ever been. It wasn't about me. It was about my kids. And I came in here and I worked the same steps. I worked another program differently than I ever did. And I went to my AA sponsor and I'm talking about this stuff. He goes, what are you doing? I go, what? I'm coming in as a sponsor. He goes, this is Al-Anon stuff. I go, what? No, you know, you're my sponsor. He goes, I'm not your Al-Anon sponsor. I go, well, you good enough? He goes, no. I don't know anything about what you're doing. You need an Al-Anon sponsor. And I found an Al-Anon sponsor precisely this way. I found three other men that I saw over the course of the couple years I was there, year and a half that I was there. Dude, your shares are, dude, you've come so far. They're all being sponsored by the same guy. And I go to lunch with the guy. He never once said anything to me. Never talks about who he sponsors. Never shares the information about who he sponsors. Nor do his people talk about who sponsors him in the meeting. I'm not sure why he rolls like that, but I like it. You know? I'm not proud, or no, I don't need to say, I mean, I'll say it as a function, but it's not like, look at me, I'm sponsoring. That's what I saw in him, pure humility. And the experience with him with it was strictly this. He was a sponsor. My role is to take you through the book, take you through the steps. I'm not a marriage counselor. I'm not a family counselor. I walked in here as jacked up as you. All I know is this. So when we talk, it will always be pertinent to work. Don't call me about this thing you're worried about until you tell me, is that a third step problem? Is that a step one problem? Did you do a little fourth step on it? Did you have a part in it? Where's God in this? I always ask you that. Now call me, because now I'm going to ask you all those things anyway. Because if I'm busy, what are you going to do? Don't lean on me. You're not my baby. We're equals. I just did the steps before you. And I'm really doing the steps to do one thing, to teach you how to take another man through the steps. So it's very specific. It's very direct. And every step that I did with him was incredibly deep, incredibly powerful, like I had never done before. And the incredible thing that I noticed about Al-Anon is the idea that it's the common solution. Regardless if you're an addict, alcoholic, sex addict, gambler, food, it's the same direction. It's the same process. We go to rooms where I identify with the share of a parent. Al, I love, where's Al? Al. It's like I know you inside and out already, and your share was my share. I mean, to a point. But that's what I need. I need brothers that are walking the walk that I am. And give me one sec. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about this idea. You know, once I started getting into step work and I started, you know, reaching another level of work, another level of application. You know, I've seen the 12 steps. I go into Al-Anon. I'm doing my step work. I understand. I get through the step work. I have a tremendous amount of information. I've done a lot of work. I've done information. I've done research. I've done work. What I haven't done is experimentation. I haven't tried applying it in any way that I can. You know, the idea of unmanageability. You know, I had to really look at truly what is unmanageability. And in that step, it tells us we are powerless over alcohol. It doesn't say we're power, my belief. And everything I say really is my translation of this. Please don't think it's the book. You know, the unmanageability is everything else. But it's our delusional chasing of the idea of powerful, of being able to control things, that actually makes our life unmanageable. I believe that the unmanageability of my life makes me insane. What makes me insane is I'm not the guy to do it. I'm not the guy to control anything. I'm merely the guy that has to live in a life in alignment with God. So I look at steps like step two, which is, you know, to me, you know, it's sort of a observational step. You know, I don't find a lot of action in that step at all. I really realize that around me, I see clearly because I'm no longer stuck in my head. I recognize as I speak to a man in program with recovery and I'm looking in your eyes and I'm hearing you talk, I came to believe that you're unbelievably loving and I don't even know you. And I just spoke to this man and I spoke to so many of you. And as we spoke, you in particular, I feel God. I don't have to be asked, do I believe in God? Because that's not the point. God don't care whether I believe in him to exist. The question is, do I have a connection with anything that resembles a God? The next question is, if I do have any kind of relationship with really a God, what does it do? How does it affect my thinking, my actions, my reactions, my emotions? I had to discover that. It says that in the book, no human power could have relieved us of this. God could and would if he were sought. Not till you're done with step 12. This is a lifetime. There is no arriving anywhere, ever. The coffin, but that will be it. You'll be working this program. I have to pay attention to how I impact people all the time, all the time. Because I'm in a fist fight and this is training. This ain't practice, I'm training. I'm in a fist fight. And my opponent's as powerful, if not more powerful, than Tyson. So there's two things I gotta know. Train like you have never trained before. Discipline yourself to get through the training like you have never done to anything else in your life. Give it 120%, okay? That's not how I do things. This is all new, to give it 100%. And then I started to see the changes. Only the most profound thing was giving it 100% was actually to stop doing certain things. So the giving was to identify the proper use of my will. We come to step three and we talk about turning our will and our life over to the care of God, right? That's our thinking. You know, our thought life is turned over to the care of God. But that's not where it's done. That's just where we said, this is what we're gonna do. We acknowledge that we're going to trust God, we're gonna let him. Now we start doing steps 4 through 9. That's our work. That was a commitment. That was the work that we said. We promised God in the arrangement in the third step prayer. God, I'm going to make a deal with you. You help me out. I'll always give myself to you, right? I'm going to turn my life and my will over to you, and I'm going to ask you to remove the bondage of self, the bondage of self. The sponsor said to me, do you know the third step prayer? And I said, yeah, let me look it up. He goes, no. What I'd like you to do is memorize that prayer. And yeah, sure, it's a little one. Thank God it's not the 11-step prayer. So, all right, I'll memorize it. And for the life of me, man, I know I'm old, but I couldn't remember it. I would say it, I'd put on a little 305 card, and I put it in my pocket, and all day I'm at work, and I'm like, I'm gonna turn my will, my life, whatever it is. Relieve me of the bond of self, you know, that, you know what it is. And I could remember it, but it made me like, say it like, I'm in the bathroom. And then I'd go out there, God damn it, and I'd do it again. I must have, in my head, said it 1,000 times. And at the end of the 2 weeks, I call him. I go, hey, man, I got it. And I said it to him, and he goes, good. How was your 2 weeks? And I went, really nice. Really nice. Wow. In that moment, I believed. It gave me the strength to pursue this, to continue with the steps. And we've talked about every one of these steps at length. And there's incredible knowledge in this room. And I couldn't tell you anything. I mean, it's so profound how well you all have worked your program. But there's things that were very important to me. And the idea was this. The purpose of this program, really, ultimately for me, is I had to accept a deck of cards I didn't want. I miss my kids. I miss my son. He's in there 4.5 years and no end date, no sentence. It's a long, complicated mess, but he hasn't touched a drug since he went in. When he had 7 guns pointed to his head and the report said the suspect did not reach for his weapon. I knew my son could have had his head blown off. And now he's in prison. He's been in 3 different prisons. He'll end up in a federal penitentiary. And I miss him. And I think about him all the time. I cry. He comes on the phone and goes, hey, Pop, how you doing? And I'm just blown away. And I heard from the FBI agent when he was being, whatever they do in the first step, pulled me aside and he goes, you know, I'm sorry this is happening to your son. I know, you know, I will tell you. He got in the car, handcuffed. He looked at me and he said, thank you. I couldn't stop. He has taught me to be powerful. He's in a prison where men have killed their families. He's not afraid. And I went to go see him up in Sac County, and you know, I get scared the whole time I'm driving. I'm just praying, like, I want to be okay when I see him. I want to be at peace when I see him. I don't want to see my son seeing me cry. And we parked down the block. And I get up at 6:30 and I do my practice. I never, ever, ever miss my practice. God never misses blessing me. The least I could do is honor him. And I'd pray in the elevator going up to the 9th floor because I hate that building. And I'd be the first person in line. I look behind me, by the time the door opens, there'd be 80 people behind me, all waiting to go see inmates. And I was the first one in line every time. And I got up to the 9th floor that he was at, and you sit in the chair. I had been on both sides of that glass. And when I was there, and my sister said, do you want Dad to come? I went, no. I'll kill my, I don't, you know what, he would come. But I was so ashamed in front of that man. That man was solid, man. He never broke the law. He never had a traffic ticket in his life. He treated my mom like gold. He treated his brother like gold. I went to church with him every single morning at 7 a.m. from the time I was 5 till I was about 12, 11. And I loved it. I didn't care I was in church. I loved being with my dad. And we'd drive home and have a donut at Cooper's Donuts. And he'd put his hand on my shoulder and he'd just squeeze it. That was his thing, man. He died about 30 years ago. And, you know, there was a period of time that I didn't really call him. And it was not quite a decade, but I didn't hate on him at all. I'd see him for his birthday and Christmas, but it wasn't like reaching out to him to interact and talk to him about my life and get advice at all. The only reason I didn't call him and my mom was I didn't think of him. I just didn't think of them. I was busy doing my thing, you know, I was growing up. You know, my dad taught me how to take care of myself. I worked hard. I worked harder than anybody I worked with. So did he. And we became the best. The best there was. We were. And that's what I tried to do when I started. You know, I was a young guy that grew up poor. And now I'm 19 cutting hair on Rodeo. I don't even know how to talk to these people, man. I don't belong here. I'm Latino. People like you use us for housekeepers and gardeners and maids. And I grew into that neighborhood and I realized, you know, I loved the way I grew up. I've met people that have a lot of, you know, things, and I'm telling you, their depth of love, their misery, their bougie problems. And I'm not saying I judge it because they just, you know, it's just their life, but I have a different depth. I have an older sister who for 40 years has a law firm that only represents undocumented workers. She started it. She was asked to work at the Department of Labor in Washington. She said, no, I have a job to do here. My other sister is a federal criminal defense attorney that graduated top of her class from Berkeley and was handed her diploma by Clarence Thomas, top of her game. And I saw that sister of mine, and I was there with my pop, and he was dying. And we just found out he was dying there. We're at Berkeley, and we're walking around. I'm like, Dad, you're not breathing good. He goes, I'm fine. I'm fine. And after the graduation, my sister's tuition was paid by a female Latino alumni group that supported and paid her college. And they honored her that night with a dinner of about 800 people, and my dad was a guest of honor. And she was the lead speaker. She had my dad stand up. And the look on my dad's face is etched in my mind. In front of everybody, he thanked her for everything he had done for her. And the problem with a lot of this experience is that I didn't do that. And it really, you know, that was a crippling thing for me that I had to discover that, you know, what was really hard is that my dad was such a good example and I couldn't follow. Until about 20 years ago when I was with my dad. And, you know, he did pass and I spent a lot of time with him. I learned about death. I learned about God. He died in the bed in his home. And he looked at me and he said, promise me, if you can, I want my wife to die in this room. And she will. She will. We guarantee it. And she's 99. She'll be 100 in February. She's lovely. She's lovely. Yeah, she's not, couldn't use a cell phone to save her life. You know, she cooked dinner, did laundry, made our lunches, took care of her husband. She honored everyone in that family. Everyone in the neighborhood loved her. All my friends loved her. And I'm not afraid of her dying. We've had her forever. I don't want her suffering, and she's not. It's a beautiful, I have a beautiful life. And I want to share something with you. Do I have a little bit of time left?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. There's something that was really important for me because as I work with, and this was more profound in Al-Anon for me, because it seemed like in A, I mean, yes, we were struggling in AA, but they're the drinking's behind them. And what I found for me is I deal with a lot of unresolved issues. And for a lot of us that are, you know, and Roger alluded to it, you know, sometimes you think, oh, it's all good now. And then you turn around, it's not. You know, your kid's sober or your wife's sober, and then they're not, you know. And then after a while, we don't ever trust it. So we live in this place where we do work these steps. We have solution. The practical use of this solution has become the critical use of what I'm going to do, because I work with people and I can't just, you know, give them these esoteric statements like easy does it. What does that mean? You know, let go, let God. Okay, that ain't enough here. I walk into an Al-Anon meeting. How you doing? I'm good, but you know, my daughter, you know, I'm really, and you're just not turning it over. You're just not turning it over. I had a guy say that to me, and I said, I'm going to ask you a favor. I don't mind that you say it. Do not use that tone with any other person. I'm going to tell you what I'd like you to say. I ran into a similar situation. I want to teach you what I did to turn it over. So I did that. I'm going to pass these cards, and, you know, it's just something I did for fun. And it really works for me, and I want to share it with you. I'm going to give you a card, and the card is going to be face up. And I want you to not turn it over. Put it on your lap. Do not turn it over and look at the other side until I tell you to. You know, it's kind of a... Yeah. And in the dark, you won't be able to read it, but I'm going to explain what it is. For me, and really this is for me to share what I don't turn it over. You're out of the game if you do. $1,000 prize from that thing you're gonna have. Okay, so this was important for me because I needed something more than what I was getting. And I've done my step work, you know, but I needed something more because I got trauma. You know, I've had calls at 2 a.m. My daughter was homeless and bad things were happening. I've had calls from FBI at, you know, and police, and, you know, so, you know, it wasn't that long ago that there was a spam call, and I normally turn my phone off. Okay? I'm fragile right now, or I have been, and in a sense. But there was a spam call at 2 a.m, and I pissed my pants. And it was a spam call. And my wife of 20 years totally understood, you know, and I'm starting to see a trauma specialist. But this was important for me because this idea of turning it over, I think, is one of the most powerful tools to use if we utilize it. And what you're going to read on the back is a process that I've utilized in the moment that something occurs that throws me. And it could be at work, it could be, you know, I have a conversation with my wife, you know, and I kind of, you know, it's kind of going sideways. I go to the bathroom, I take a second, and I do the process of turning it over. Now, I'll preface it with this. I do believe it was compelled by turn our will and our life over to the care of God. So it's an abbreviated version of turning it over. It's abbreviated version of stage step 3. I kind of changed it, okay? That would be handing it over. Turning it over is what I do when I flip a pancake, okay? I flip it. So turn your cards over now, and I want to talk a little bit about this. So the first thing to do, I won't use the word step, is to be objective. Okay, we are not objective in the moment of crisis. We're purely subjective. We're going by our emotions. We're going by what we believe the situation to be. And in that moment, the first thing to do is to get to the facts. Just the facts. What happened? We're done. Not what you think of it. Not is it good or bad. Not is it the worst thing possible. Here's what we're talking about. I have a son in prison and a daughter that does heroin. I'm done. To control my emotions. In those moments, I realize I don't breathe. I don't even know I'm not breathing. And the beautiful thing about Diego, Diego takes a soft breath every time he's about to share. In the moment that you're in, right there, and I can show you something simple, and I want you all to do this. Sit comfortably, and I want you to just take a 10-second slow breath. Slow, take it in, all the way down to your abdomen. Push your abdomen out, and just hold it for 10 seconds. Slowly take 10 seconds to let it out. And that helps me so much, because at the moment that I hear something that I don't want to hear, think something I don't want to think, the first thing I need to do before I do anything else is bring everything way, way down. I need to de-escalate the situation here. I never make a good decision in panic mode. The third one is to choose to see the good in a situation. That's turning it over. To look at a situation like my son in prison and to know it's exactly where God wanted him to be. He'd be dead if he wasn't there, or he would have murdered someone. He's grateful to be there. I had to accept it. My daughter is working. She lives in an apartment. She has a guy. He is not a drug addict, but my daughter functions as a heroin addict. We're done. To steady my nerves is four, prayer and meditation. The problem with prayer is we always believe it to be somehow connected to a religious belief or an entity or a deity or whatever it is. It doesn't have to be anything. It's an intention. It's the first thing I do in the morning, merely by kneeling by the side of my bed and asking God to give me the strength to live in his will. It doesn't say I'm Protestant, Catholic, or Jewish. It's getting my attention. I'm reminded that I'm not God. Meditation for me is nothing spiritual. It's just a period of time. I've developed a transcendental meditation practice over 40 years that works for me. I do it twice a day religiously. If I need to throw in another, I will. If I have a lot on my mind before I go to sleep, I'll meditate for 3 minutes only and then go to sleep, and I sleep soundly. So the meditation practice and the prayer practice for me serves as a way to get calm. That's all. People say they hear God. Maybe you do. Maybe you heard the neighbor. I don't know. maybe you do. This is a really good one. Five is to ignore what disturbs or limits others. I used to wake up in the morning and make myself imagine how could my son be feeling right now. He's got to be, you know, and I would be in prison with him. In LA, in my bed. Because my empathy will kill me. It isn't productive at all. I'm not helping him. I'm not being a good father. I have things to do. I have things to do with steady feet, soft composure. I don't have the liberty to go there. When I engage with anyone, it happened the other day. I had a very good friend of mine. He's my physician. I cut his hair 40 years, cutting his hair, sitting in my chair. I got a program. I kind of know how to do this, right? I'm just cutting my dude's hair. Starts talking. What does he tell me? I can believe this, Dave. My daughter's beautiful marriage. I've known her since she was a little girl, and she's mid-30s. It's falling the hell apart. Now, this is a man who had told me how beautiful their marriage was. It's great. Everything's great, right? Finds out his daughter's been being abused, and marriage is falling apart. all kinds of financial fears, and I've never seen him so like ramped up. I want to help him. So I tell him, well, you know, your daughter might have had a part in this. Not what you want to say to a man worried about his daughter. I said, well, you know, you're telling me all this stuff about this guy. Did you see that going? He goes, well, no, and he's still talking. He goes, well, maybe you're just hearing her side of it. Not what I should have said to this guy. And I could tell I'm getting agitated because he doesn't even hear me. I was so in the wrong. And he left. We kind of said goodbye. You know, we're civilized, you know, but it felt weird. Went home, went to my meeting. I didn't think about it a whole lot. The next morning, I got up. I felt it. And I prayed. I did my meditation without any idea at all. I picked up my phone because I couldn't call him. He was in the office. And I wrote him not just an apology, but the idea that I understand that you're in a lot of pain over your daughter. I understand that you're in fear. My prayers are for you and your daughter and your son-in-law, that you find harmony and peace. And I'm so sorry for opening my mouth when I should have just been a friend. I love you deeply. And he wrote me back. He said, it's probably one of the nicest things ever done. I love you too. And that's what this program gives me. It gives me the tools to do things like this. 7 is to revert to the present moment. And we all know what that does. You know, that calms us down. You know, how you do it is up to you. I do it by, you know, engaging in conversation. I don't do it by watching television. I don't do it by looking at my phone. I do it by engaging with another human being and sitting there looking at you speak to me face to face, not allowing another thought to come in my head to interrupt the flow of listening to what you're saying. I got to work at that. But I have to listen to every word you say, even if I don't agree or whatever it is. And I get calmer by focusing in the moment. And we talk about in the big book about, you know, being rocketed to the fourth dimension. It's been said for so long. I'm like, I don't even know where I'm being rocketed to. I thought it was just peace of mind. And Einstein had written that the fourth dimension, there's three prior to that. Height, width, depth. Number 4 is time. Time is right here, right now. The last one is to focus on what can be controlled. And that's a powerful connection to the serenity prayer. And the points of this serenity prayer that I now have noticed is, you know, it's critical to understand we ask God for the serenity to accept. I want the serenity to accept what I can't accept, what I can't control. And the second is the courage. And I'm not talking light courage. This takes incredible courage to let go of things that kept us stable. And that's the most powerful use of our will, is to not use it. That's using our will. I believe something really critical. There's only one choice that we have free will to make. And that is whether or not we're going to turn it over to God, or we're going to let our character defects run our life. Because if we had free will, I wouldn't be here. My character defects have hijacked my free will, and I'm the last to know it. I've gotten better at control. I'm suave at control. I'm a hairdresser. You know, I know how to say what I need to say in the most charming way to make you do what I need you to do. It's horrible. It makes me feel horrible. So I'm going to go a little bit over because I do this weird thing. I carry this thing around. I don't, you know, text on or anything like that. I put it on the microphone. And I'm thinking out loud about program, things I'm learning. I'm doing it on my way to work. And it's things like this. little quote, not quotes, but little ideas that I have, because I want to leave with this. We're almost done, right? Close? Okay, these are things that I'm not going to elaborate on a whole lot at all. I won't bore you anymore. The idea came to me one night that trying to live your dream was my nightmare. What happens when you turn over that chip on your shoulder? What happens when you stop judging? What happens when you turn over every single belief you have? And be specific. Our attachments to a result results in a real dysfunctional response. I tend to read you and everything else wrong. Signs of needing to let go and turn things over and to be present. One, you're talking to me for 5 minutes, and when you're done, I have no idea what you said because I wasn't present. I'm in a meeting, people are sharing. I am nowhere near that room. I am nowhere near anyone. I'm out there. I've left the room. I don't do too much anymore, but I used to do it all the time. It is the obsession of self in desperate need. Self in desperate need to be out of self is insanity. My pain comes from I'm not close enough to God. How do I connect to the power? Where's the socket? How do I utilize this power that we claim is the power we need? What exactly, now that I have blind faith of the outcome, that I can trust that I am exactly where I should be? Not where I want to be, but where I should be. I begin to understand I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's useless. Oh, sorry. So, I don't know if these cards will help you at all. You know, I want to finish up. Sorry, I want to finish up by saying that I have spent 3/4 of my life, if not more, in meetings. And I've been in meetings where I never wanted to go. I didn't want to be part of this. I hated people in here. And then I tolerated being here. And then I was okay with being here. And then my friends were here. And then life made me want to be here because I needed to be here. I didn't like how I felt when I wasn't here, so I might as well go. And somewhere in there, man, I fell in love with this program. So in love with the idea that I feel safe. And my dad used to say in Spanish, God won't protect you from anything, but he will get you through everything. And I really believe that. The idea that we have obstacles and we feel bad that we have obstacles, everybody has them. It's how do you respond to the obstacles? I have to have the confidence in this program. Utter confidence. I can get through anything if I'm involved with my steps 10, 11, and 12. It is my duty. It is my obligation to take other men through these steps. My son is in prison and my daughter is on heroin right now for the single purpose that I've suffered enough that I've gotten closer to God and I do have a purpose. And the purpose is to take other people through the steps. No one else can take anyone through the steps but us. No one. And when I take a man through the steps, there is that beautiful thing where I get more depth of knowledge and more experience, because now it's not just my experience. And it's way deeper than hearing you share in a meeting. I've sat with you for 5 hours. I know more about your wife than her mom does. I know everything. And I mean, you're, yeah. But, you know, I know everything about this guy that I just met a month ago. And he was willing to trust me with his life. You know, parents call me to talk to their kid. I'm so honored. And every kid I sponsor, they're my kid's age. I sponsor a kid named Gabriel. My son's Gabriel. And I pray to God, I wish my son was sitting in front of me. This kid is. I prayed to my sponsor, like, dude, these guys, I got more guys asking me just because I have long hair. And they don't even know what they're getting into. And they ask me for help, and they ask me for advice, and they want me to work with them. They call me. 10 years I have kids calling me still. They don't even live here anymore. And I just, we're like family. We've shared so much. And I said to him, I want this with my kids, and I don't have it. I don't have it with my kids. He goes, well, in case you haven't noticed, David, all those kids, they have dads, but they're calling you. You may not be the guy to talk to your son, but you will be the guy to walk with your son. I don't have to be his guru. I don't. What makes me think I should? I just love him. He's a grown man. He has survived 4 years in prison. And at Sac County, when I sat up in front of the glass and we get 20 minutes, and I come back in the afternoon, I get another 20. But, you know, we're right in the middle of something really just good, and the thing just cuts off. And I hear him, he yells in the back, he goes, hey, Joe. Like, you get to do that? And here comes this man in uniform. He goes, yeah, what's up, Gaby? Gaby? Like, what do you need? He goes, yeah, man, it's my pop. Can I get more time? He goes, yeah. He looks down and goes, love your kid. Take all the time you want. And I miss him. And I don't want to worry about my daughter anymore. But she is on heroin. We have meals together. She visits grandma. She dotes over grandma. She's beautiful. She passes physicals. She just went to the dentist. Now her teeth are good. I have no idea what this means, but I love her. I love her to death. And, you know, this program has taught me a very weird thing I can do. I can cry tears and laugh, because that's the life I have. In that room of parent Al-Anon, I met my wife. What I didn't know is that I already work with her daughter. I had no idea. And I met her, and there was a bunch of fellowship, just friends. A couple years later, we went out, and I'm now married to this woman. And I have the most incredible life I couldn't imagine having a better life. I couldn't. I love her to death. And it's like to be on Medicare and meet a hot new chick is pretty damn good. Right? And she holds my face and says, you are my whole world. And she understands. We go to meetings together. We meditate together. I sit next to my wife in a meeting. I share everything with her. I would never, ever talk badly about her. I would never do anything but love her. I was not always the man that gave back. I took. And I really hurt my kid's mom. I really did. At the time, I just talked shit about her. And I cheated on her. I wasn't near recovery. I thought I was, because I wasn't, you know, I thought I was. I wasn't drinking. But, you know, I had to look at some really hard, cold facts about myself, and that is that where is he? You said it to me today. You looked me dead in the eye, and you only quoted one line. The most important line: it is better to comfort than to be comforted. If I can simply live in that state of mind. And I said earlier today something about living in states of mind, because I see people do things like, and nothing against it, but I don't do gratitude lists. A lot of things I don't do because I prefer to pursue a state of gratitude. I pursue a state of humility. I pursue a state of surrender. It has to be constant. This program has to be lived in constantly. The really cool thing is when you really, really work it hard and you start taking people through the steps, there is a time when we learn the language of recovery, we learn the language of Al-Anon, and we're learning a second language. We got our first language, and then we got our second language, right? And we only use it like wink, wink, like, you know, you see someone from the program, you're like, right? We got that language, right? It's different from everything else. It's my second language. Al-Anon is my first language. Now, I think in Al-Anon. I think a God-centered life. One of the best lines I heard was, you know, we have a self-centered existence. We have to learn to be other-centered, just other-centered. And that simple shift frees me from everything. I don't have an easy time making a list of my character defects and remembering, I got to stop doing this. You know, I just don't have the mind space for that. I got to get to the root behind what compels the launching of those, which is self-centered fear. The focus isn't on, of course, we want to really dive deep in the 6 and 7, but it's the self-centered fear that controls everything. And I will continue to go back to those defects of character if that's all I'm doing. If I'm not honoring and aware that I have not turned my will and my life for the care of God, there's no chance of maintaining what you've learned in step 4. There's no chance of maintaining the amends where you were not going to repeat behavior, because we really haven't shifted out of who's running the show, right? And I'm not good at driving the show. I'm good at being directed. I like structured life. I do really well in a structured life. Wouldn't go in the military because I hate guns, but I had a training program that was structured. I was a national level cyclist after, you know, a couple of decades, and I learned the most disciplined life I had ever had in every single sleep, diet, training at 5:30 in the morning, coming home, driving my kids to school, coming back, getting ready for work, going to work, doing all the people I had to do, coming home, jumping on my trainer, sitting for dinner, watching what I eat, home by 10, okay? And I trained with an Olympian. I trained for a year, okay? I had only been in it for 3 years, and I asked him to train me. And he had raced Tour de France, and he said, you sure? I said, I want to do what you want to do. He goes, I hope you're ready. And every single day was a specific set of training programs, technique, fitness, body fat, breathing techniques, sitting on the bike properly, positioning yourself in a race, when to sprint for a turn. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on and on. And I'm looking at him like, I had no idea we were doing all this. And he goes, David, you asked me to train you. Everything matters. Every detail matters if you want to do well. The end of that year, I got second at state champions. And I beat two former Olympians, two national champions. And I looked at him, he just had this little grin. And I didn't care if I ever did well in the race again, because I remember being with him at his home. And we're shooting the shit in his house. And I said, so where is it? Where's what? The medal. I want to see your medal. He goes, it's in the kitchen drawer. Huh? I open it and there's an Olympic medal in the kitchen drawer. I said, why do you have it in there? He goes, yeah, I had it up in the other house. But yeah, you know what? Really, David, what was way more important to me was what I did. The sacrifices I made, the discipline that I had, the commitment that I made. I did it when I didn't want to do it. We train when we don't want to. We train harder when we don't want to. And it was a principle of living life that I'm grateful that I had that sport along with this program and the friends that I have, the career that I have, the family that I have, and my children. I truly love this life and love y'all. So thank you so much for giving me your time. I appreciate it. Thank you.